website, and that's www.thejerusalemfund.org. You're listening to Arab Voices on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of the show. Did you know that this program, Arab Voices, has been on the air since April 2002? That's right, over 18 years of weekly Arab Voices programming, covering different topics and more than 1,000 expert guests that have appeared on this show from around the globe. All of that has been possible because of your support to KPFT over the years, our community radio station. Because KPFT is currently in membership drive, please call right now to support KPFT at 713-526-5738 and make a tax-deductible contribution, or make it online at kpft.org or by sending a text message with the word GIVE to 713-526-5738. We know that not everyone can contribute, but if you can and appreciate what KPFT brings you and everybody else every day, please consider a pledge, because KPFT relies on you, the listeners, for support. In fact, KPFT is 100% financed by listeners like you. The phones are open. There is room for your call. Help keep up the momentum. Please call 713-526-5738. Or donate online at kpft.org. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week,
you are listening to KBOO Portland.
Good morning and welcome to this month's episode of Voices for the Animals. This is a program where we give a voice to the sentient creatures with whom we share this planet. I'm your host and producer for this month, Michelle Coppola. Today we have a really full program, one I hope that will spur you to take some action, especially if you recognize that the ocean and the animals in it are absolutely essential to our own survival. On the show today, we'll be talking to Stephanie Brendel, the executive director of Shark Allies in Los Angeles, about the looming potential slaughter of up to 500,000 sharks in the name of a vaccine for COVID-19. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking with Michelle Bender, ocean rights manager at the Earth Law Center, about efforts to release Lolita, an orca that has been in captivity here in the U.S. for over 50 years. That's a heartbreaking story, but there are people fighting to help Lolita have a happier ending. First, though, we know that sharks sadly have a very bad but undeserved reputation with humans, but the fact is that they are incredible animals and a very necessary part of the ocean ecosystem. Unfortunately, sharks have been hunted extensively, some species to the point of extinction, so their parts can be used for a number of purposes, including for vaccines. Most recently, scientists and conservationists have sounded the alarm about plans to kill as many as 500,000 sharks to produce a vaccine against COVID-19. Here to talk about that is Stephanie Brendel, founder and executive director of Shark Allies. We're so glad to have you here, Stephanie. Thank you and welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
So there is a lot to unpack with this issue, but first, a lot of people probably would be surprised to know that sharks are even used in vaccines, but actually this has been happening for a long time, right?
Yes. Shark oil is turned into shark squalene, and squalene is used in cosmetics and also as an adjuvant in vaccines. It has been used in flu vaccines before. It's not in every vaccine, but an adjuvant basically is used in some vaccines that it serves as a booster. It stimulates the immune system, and it also allows for less of the antigen to be used. So essentially, all the antigen will go a lot further and can make more vaccines. So adjuvants are a great thing. The problem is when an adjuvant that is potentially needs to be used for a global supply is based on an wild animal population, then that is potentially, well, it's unsustainable over the long range. It may not be immediately, a problem, and nobody's going out and instantly killing 500,000 sharks. That's a little bit of a misunderstanding from headlines. We understand that nobody is out there to hunt them down right now. But the problem is that the vaccine market is so, it's not very transparent where and when sharks are used. and how many will be in production. If it's not very likely that that you know all the vaccines for COVID will have shark adjuvants in them, but the problem is that we have coronaviruses for many more years to come, and each time there's a new vaccine developed, and maybe it will have to be given seasonally, it just continues and multiplies the problem basically.
So are there non-animal alternatives to shark squalene that can be used, and are they just as effective?
Yes, from all the research and from all the communications that we've had with scientists and chemists and even vaccine and squalene producers. First of all, yes, squalene can be made from many sources, many plant sources, algae, yeast, bacteria, sugarcane, amaranth, olives, that all those plants can make high quality squalene. The way squalene becomes vaccine grade is really lies in the purification process. And that is similarly difficult or easy, whether you take it from a plant or from an animal. But essentially, by the time oil gets turned into squalene, the compounds and the parts of that is exactly the same, whether you use a plant or an animal. And obviously for cosmetics industry, they've already been switching over to plant-based squalene in many cases because it is, you know, people are more conscientious about it. And it is as effective. And from just the most recent conversations I've had with alternative vaccine producers in the biotech area, they say that the vaccine, that the squalene that they can produce, they can do a billion doses a month, and it is fully controlled, synthesized sugarcane squalene that can be reproduced at the same level over and over again. It's scalable, and apparently it can directly replace shark squalene in adjuvants and not just in cosmetics. So the alternatives are available. It's the willingness to switch over and let go of what has been done. Change is always hard. There's always cost involved. We don't say that it isn't, but the excuse that it is cheaper and easier to do is really not usually how conscientious.
Right. Yeah, I was going to ask you. Yeah. Well, you know, why is it that the pharmaceutical companies won't consider using these alternatives first? It just seems like it would be the right thing to do.
I think it's just been available and hasn't been questioned. And I think that nobody has necessarily done it out of ill will. I don't think anyone is going out and going, I'm going to kill some sharks to make potions. You know, I think it's just been available. Maybe the awareness that what impact it has, part of it is not being aware, doing business as usual, not seeing the reason why one should switch, and also the perception that shark oil and squalene is easy and cheap to come by, and they're being told that it's sustainable, it's just a byproduct, don't worry about it, those sharks would die anyway.
So they're being told that by the fishing industry?
I mean, that's generally what happens with all shark products. You know, don't worry about the fins. We're catching them for meat anyway. And then the meat guys say, well, you know, we're catching meat sharks, but if we don't sell the fins, it's not worth it. And then the cosmetics industry will say, oh, don't look at us because the fin guys are much worse. The vaccine guys say, oh, don't look at us because the cosmetics guys are much worse. The fact remains that the target list of sharks for shark liver oil is pretty extensive, and a lot of those sharks are endangered species or on CITES listings, and only a few of them are meat sharks. So what are those sharks being taken for in the first place? Well, maybe they are being taken for fins, and then the byproduct are livers, but that's a problem in itself. You know, one bad product justifying another product doesn't make it a good product. Two wrongs don't make a right. That is the problem. Each product that you take from the animal encourages this overfishing of sharks, and the of 100 plus million sharks being taken globally every year. So everybody likes to point at someone else, but I think each industry has to own their own responsibility, especially when there are alternatives. We're not losing human lives. We're not holding up a vaccine. Nothing bad happens to humans if we replace this adjuvant with plant-derived. There are solutions, and that's what we're getting at.
Well, you touched on this a little bit about the shark finning industry for shark fin soup. A lot of people are aware of that, and their fins are just cut off sometimes, and the sharks are thrown back into the ocean to die. Maybe they are used for meat. But the extraction and harvesting of sharks for vaccines can also be like equally as cruel for expediency, right? Can you explain how this happens sometimes?
In some cases, we've become aware of this practice of livering where sharks that are pulled up they could technically just let them go because they're not good for meat or for fins, but they are being, you know, their livers are taken. And of course, when you cut a shark open and take their liver, they die. It's, you know, especially in the commercial fishing industry, things happen very quickly. They don't take great pains to make sure the animal has a peaceful
humane death. Yeah.
It's pretty quick slice and dice and throw the rest away. But, you know, whether it is a byproduct or whether it is targeted, the fact that, you know, some of the rarest deep water species of sharks that are really not edible, but they have extremely large livers, if they're not already being targeted, they could surely be targeted, because when you have an animal that has 20 to 30% of their body weight is oil, is liver, and that mm-hmm. liver is filled with oil that you want, somebody that, you know, especially people that don't value sharks as anything important, and it's just some product that they want to get, it's a very easy incentive to get that animal that could normally be let go if it was bycatch, or that wouldn't even be targeted.
You know, I want to circle back to something you touched on a little bit ago. To give people some perspective, you and other conservationists, activists, and scientists are involved in trying to stop this use. You're not in any way saying that the sharks are more important than creating a vaccine or than saving human lives. Can you explain a little bit your position on this?
Sure. I think the knee-jerk reaction immediately is when you say, please don't use this in such and such product, immediately people shut down and say, you're taking something away from us, or you're trying to put sharks in front of human health or human survival. In this case, that's not at all the case. And in the case of the vaccines, we didn't even start this until we knew that there are viable alternatives. So really what it means is that we can take care of humans and of sharks at the same time. Not a single person will have to go without a vaccine because we're working on this campaign. We've said from the beginning, if the first round of vaccines have to contain shark because this is where the testing is going, well, then so be it. But what we're saying is the sooner we are starting to look at alternatives, because then they have to be tested, and then the industry has to accept them, and then, you know, agencies like the FDA have to approve things. There's still a long road to go, and the longer we wait, the more we rely on this resource that is very limited, and that limited resource will become more limited, and then it's also not really a secure supply, and it will get to the point where the price of that oil will go up because it becomes more rare, and then it also could limit how many doses you can make. What if the very best COVID vaccine turns out to be the one that is adjuvanted? Wouldn't it be great if we could mass produce it like crazy, consistently, from something that we don't have to take from a wild animal, that doesn't have to be overfished? Wouldn't that be a much better solution? Because in the end, that would be better for humans too, because we would know it is something we can reproduce over and over and over. When people talk about harvesting sharks, it's a really bad term, because we don't grow sharks. We just go out and get them. And harvest implies that it's something that you can just, that grows back, and it doesn't. So we can't farm them. We can't grow them. They don't grow back their liver. They don't grow back their fins. And the recovery and restoration of shark populations in the ocean is very slow. Once you take out a whole generation of breeding adults, it takes a long time for new adults to come along, because the way they grow and mature, more like mammals, you know, when you think of whales or humans, they have to be in their teenage years before they have young, and then they only have, you know, a litter every other year potentially. So this is not like tuna, who, you know, tuna reproduces within the first year and thousands of eggs. So if you leave tuna, and even they are endangered, but if you leave them alone for a couple of years, they can bounce back fairly quickly.
Right.
But sharks do not, because they evolve to be hunters, not to be hunted.
sharks, obviously, as I mentioned earlier, they have a little bit of a PR problem. Can you explain why sharks are so essential to the ecosystem of the ocean, and how endangered are some of the species at this point?
Well, the, you know, our planet is covered by ocean 70%, and it's the engine of our planet. So what happens in the ocean is very important. To have biodiversity in the ocean is incredibly important because, you know, we've done a pretty bad job at keeping that biodiversity on land, but then we invent things like, okay, farms, fences, you know, even robot technology. We kind of try to make up for our shortcomings on land. We're not going to be able to do that in the ocean. Sharks have evolved over millions of years to fill a very important part in most ecosystems at any depth and in any part of the ocean. And they're the regulators. If you can think of them as the white blood cells of the ocean, where they take out the diseased, the dead, the dying, they make sure that, you know, diseases won't spread to other populations. This affects everything from the very largest animals down to the coral reef, because it affects reef grazers, and which then affect algae growth and coral. So you take sharks out of the equation, it can have a cascading effect all the way down to maybe the crustaceans and the food fish that you want to catch. So you can absolutely not love sharks, but still see how important they are.
You know, you mentioned a little earlier that the headline of, you know, as many as 500,000 sharks could be killed for a COVID-19 vaccine is a little bit misleading. Can you give me a better interpretation of what could possibly happen with regard to this?
Yeah, so this number was sort of like giving the COVID vaccine a reference, mm-hmm. but when people say that's too many, I'm like, well, we didn't even add up all the other use and the continued use, because we don't know that the first vaccine coming out is going to actually help everyone. Maybe only 50% of the people respond to it. We don't know if this is going to be a seasonal shot. Nobody says, people think they're going to get one vaccine for COVID and then we're done. It could be seasonal, like a flu vaccine. So are we going to get COVID vaccine shots like we do the flu every year? So the trajectory of this is pretty unpredictable. And it's, you know, a couple 100,000 sharks equivalent. We're not saying they're only taken for vaccine, but the equivalent of that could easily multiply into many more. We know that the trajectory is when more vaccine adjuvants that are made from sharks are being patented and used, then they will be promoted and then they will be used, which is just a limited, unsustainable practice that we should change sooner or later.
Right. Well, and it's good to get in front of it before the system already gets moving.
I mean, with endangered species, what is our track record? We are always complaining and doing nothing until they have to be on the list. So we're saying, why don't we get ahead of a problem for once? I mean, we're not even really truly ahead. We're just sort of potentially have a chance to redirect this. But why do we have to wait until we have definitive proof that, yes, this is going to be a bad thing?
You know, Stephanie, this is such important information. And I want to make sure that everybody has a link where they can go read more about this issue and where maybe they can get involved, sign a petition. Can you give us that?
Yes, please go to sharkallies.org. And we have a section that's called Shark Free Products. And we have lots of information on squalene, on the industry. Please read those blogs, because each one kind of addresses a part that we discussed today. And there's a lot of information. There are links to research. Nothing that we have put out there has been just us, our opinion. It's based on what we have found. And then we also have a petition that, you know, you can reach the petition from our website or at change.org. If you type in, you know, sharks and COVID, it will come up. It is a Shark Allies petition to address towards the regulatory agencies and the manufacturers to please consider testing the alternatives and discontinuing shark squalene as soon as they can. On social media, we're at Shark Allies on most of the channels. Yeah, I mean, the best thing that we want everyone to do is to get informed about it. You know, we're not attacking anyone. We're not trying to make trouble for anyone. We're not trying to go against vaccine companies at all. I would love to actually talk to them. They haven't been very open, and probably for a good reasons. I don't know, but we're not out to get anyone. We want to work with everyone to find the best solutions.
You're listening to Voices for the Animals on KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Michelle Coppola. So a couple of months ago on this program, we did a show about animal tourism, and one of the areas we focused on was the use of aquatic mammals in entertainment shows at places like SeaWorld and Marineland. We talked about the terrible lives they live in that sort of captivity, and you're probably aware of Keiko, the real-life orca whale who starred in Free Willy. Remember him? He was eventually released from the park in Mexico where he was living in a small tank, and spent some time here in Oregon at the Newport Aquarium, as a matter of fact, before he was released in Iceland. Well, the thing is, many, many whales are still imprisoned in that kind of inhumane captive misery, and one of them is Lolita. She's been living isolated in a small tank in Miami for over 50 years now, as of September. There's been a concerted effort to free her, and with us today is Michelle Bender, Ocean Rights Manager at the Earth Law Center. They have joined the Lummi Nation in their fight to get Lolita released, and by the way, Lolita is only her stage name. The Lummi have given her a better one. It's Scalichaktinot. And yes, I practiced that a few times before trying to say it on the air. Welcome to the show, Michelle. Did I get that right?
You're pretty close, yeah.
Pretty close. I won't try it again then. So we appreciate you being here. And let's go back a little bit and talk about the story of Lolita's capture and how she came to be at the Miami Seaquarium.
Yeah, so Lolita, as you noted, it is her stage name. Others have known her throughout the years by Togete, and then most recently is Scalichaktinot from the Lummi Nation. So she was actually captured 50 years ago, August 8th, 1970, with approximately 79, 80 other orcas in the area of Penn Cove, Washington. My understanding of this capture is that they used tactics like bomb droppings and aircrafts, you know, loud noises from boats to really drive the orcas into this shallow cove so that they could be captured. And Scalichaktinot was one of those captured. She was believed to be about 3 or 4 years old at the time and was then sold to the Miami Sea Aquarium about a month later. When she arrived on September 24th of that same year. And she's now the last survivor of the southern residents that were captured that day.
They captured 79 to 80 whales that day. They didn't just take a few out of that pod.
Yeah, it was one of the largest single day captures in history.
So what is her life like at the Miami Seaquarium?
Well, she spent, you know, about 50 years in what you could equate to a prison. You know, it's the smallest orca tank in the world. The metrics of her tank, it's 80 feet long, 35 feet wide, and 20 feet deep. Putting that in perspective, Scalichaktinot herself is 22 feet long.
Yeah, she's longer than her tank is deep.
Yeah, exactly. So she can't even dive fully. And as we know, wild orcas, you know, they actually swim upwards of 40 miles a day and dive to depths of, you know, 100 to 500 feet just to find food. So that is incredibly limiting. And before the pandemic, I believe she was performing at least 2 shows a day. You know, with that small of a tank, she's been vulnerable to the hot sun, hurricane seasons.
And of course, she's isolated most of the time, yes?
Yeah, I mean, she did have a fellow orca with her, Hugo, for about 10 years. He died in 1980, and some scientists, vets, experts believe that he died from a brain aneurysm that was actually the result of self-inflicted harm by banging his head against the wall. You know, an orca's brain is 2.5 times on average the size of a human brain. So you can only imagine the psychological stress that must incur from that much solitude and confinement.
So, you know, ELC, as I mentioned earlier, is joining along with the Lummi Nation in Bellingham, Washington area, near where Lolita was captured. And they're really kind of leading this fight. Why is freeing her so important to the Lummi Nation?
Well, the essence of their way of knowing and doing, and I would say indigenous peoples in general, is really based on this deep respect for nature, all species and ecosystems. You know, specifically, they consider orcas or Quetzalcoatl as their relations underwater. So they consider orcas as their family and their kin, you know, their aunt, their sister. And, you know, particularly we're partnering with 2 members of the Lummi Nation, Ellie and Raynal, also known by Tomas and Skilahele. And they believe they've been called on to bring her home. You know, orcas, salmon, the Salish Sea, it's all a deep part of their existence, their culture, their spiritual, you know, practices. And so they believe that the Salish Sea and themselves as a nation cannot be whole or heal without her home.
So it's an extremely important fight. This is a matter of family for them.
Yeah.
So how long has the effort to free her been going on, and when did your organization become involved in the fight?
Oh gosh, it's been going on for decades.
Really?
It's been led by organizations like PETA, Orca Network, Animal Legal Defense Fund. Throughout the years, they've launched over 6 legal actions to try to release her. These have been largely under, you know, the Endangered Species Act or Animal Welfare Act, you know, trying to find some ways to encourage her release. And, you know, we didn't come into this until this year, actually, in June, when we started partnering with Ellie and Raynell, even though they began their own personal campaign, like I said before. And we really just felt we had a, you know, this moral and ethical obligation to do so.
It's really just a heartbreaking situation. And what I don't understand is, aside from the fact that she's a moneymaker, or at least was before COVID closed the parks, what reasons is this aquarium giving for not releasing Lolita? I mean, wouldn't it be a great public relations win for them? Why won't they do this?
Yeah, I mean, many of the responses I have seen from the aquarium when they've been reached out to from media, for example, you know, throughout the years, it's along the lines of, we believe she's well cared for, she's loved here, we know how to take care of her, and that moving her, they believe, would only harm her. But, you know, as I noted, we know that orcas are sentient beings with emotions, culture, and we also know that other relocations have been successful. I know we'll speak more to that in a little bit, but the world in general, people are raising awareness to try to end this captive industry. So I do think that this would be a great public relations win for them, you know, not only because of this larger movement that's occurring with animal rights, but because it would also be about honoring and respecting the rights of the Lummi Nation and Indigenous rights.
We do want to circle back a little bit to what you were mentioning about they feel like she might not thrive in the wild. And a lot of people feel that Keiko, when he was released all those years ago, didn't thrive when he was released in Iceland. Although a lot of organizations involved consider his release a success because, hey, he got 5 years of relative freedom and, you know, more of a natural life than he'd ever had. One of the problems I understood there was that because he'd been captured so young and he'd lived so much of his life in captivity, he really couldn't break the need for human contact. So my questions here are, is there concern that this might be the case for Lolita since she's a lot older than Keiko was and has been in captivity longer? And what's the plan to keep her healthy and make the release successful should the aquarium finally agree to release her?
I mean, certainly it is a concern. And I'll just start by saying I'm not an expert on the logistics.
Right. Yeah.
I do know, just because of the broader campaign, that there are experts that are collaborating on developing an operational plan in anticipation of the Seaquarium agreeing to her release. And this is actually something that groups have been thinking about for years. And, you know, when you're looking at the development of this plan, we're bringing in experts that have specialized experience in marine mammal rescue, transport, research, rehabilitation, but also those that have expertise in pathology and disease transfer, for example, because you want to make sure you have all the steps necessary are covered. And you want to ensure that we're bringing Skelly-Tactinet home in a safe and responsible manner. So this includes pre-transport evaluation, you know, making sure she is actually okay and healthy to transport with the necessary tests and whatnot, you know, husbandry, conditioning her for the move. And then, you know, looking at what needs to be done to ensure that she's taking care of when she's on an on-site sanctuary here in the Salish Sea, what sort of medical long-term enrichment she might need. You know, obviously the long-term goal is to see her, you know, swimming freely, but that can only happen if it's within her best interest, just like it was with Kaikos.
Yeah. And she's 50 now. How long do orcas naturally live in the wild?
Well, you know, there are some a part of the pod right now that are believed to be over 80. And one of those is actually, they're not sure, but it could be her mom.
Wow. So there's a chance she could have 30 more years of a happy, at least somewhat normal life were she returned to the Lummi Nation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So do you have any idea how many orcas still live in captivity around the world? Again, I know you're not an expert on all things orca, but I know there's one that they're also campaigning to release up in Canada, the Canadian Marine Land. Are they still being actively stolen from the wild for entertainment purposes, or are they protected in most places? What's the status now?
There's approximately 59 orcas left in captivity in about 7 countries, and until now, and only about 19 of those have happened since 2002. So just, you know, those numbers show that there has been a decline. And, you know, as I noted earlier, there's certainly a movement away from this, from not only capturing, but allowing breeding programs and amusement shows to continue. So just in, you know, the U.S., California passed the Orca Protection Act in 2017. And that bans holding orcas in activity for entertainment purposes and captive breeding programs. And then we're also seeing entire countries such as Costa Rica, Chile, Switzerland, India, New Zealand.
France just did it as well.
Yeah. Just within the last week. They're passing these laws banning the practices, or even going further and passing laws that recognize that animals are sentient beings with rights, like they did in New Zealand. So this is just amazing to see.
It really is amazing. So what I want to know is, with regard to Tokite, I'm not going to attempt to pronounce her Lummi Nation name again. With regard to her, what can people do if they want to get involved in the fight to help free her or other captive whales around the world?
Yeah, more broadly, you know, businesses listen to consumers and demand. So the public can take action by not supporting places that have cetaceans on display, taking that action with the money you choose to spend or not to spend, right?
Right.
And particularly for our next steps. So we're currently exploring, you know, all legal pathways to encourage her release, but we're also building this public awareness and support campaign. So for those wanting to get involved, you know, first we have this petition on change.org. And we're asking people to please sign and share. You know, this is specific to not only Scalitaktinut's rights, but indigenous rights, this idea of family and kinship. We also have a solidarity letter that's specifically for indigenous leaders to support this campaign. So we've had indigenous leaders from the Maori tribe in New Zealand, Cowichan tribe in Canada, the Nez Perce in Idaho, and the Ponca Nation in Oklahoma. They've all signed on in support of publicly honoring this campaign and wanting to see, you know, the Lummi Nation bring her home. You know, I would just say finally, you know, Earth Law Center, we're always accepting volunteers. So we're always happy to take any, you know, help that you feel like you can give. You know, you don't need a certain type of expertise. And then, you know, if you feel like you don't have the time, of course, you can always donate as well to help support this campaign.
Thank you so much, Michelle. And thanks to Stephanie from Shark Allies who joined us earlier in the show. If you want to know more about either of these important issues, we'll have all the links up on our Facebook page and on our Voices for the Animals page at the KABU website. Until next month, thank you for listening and be kind to animals, non-human and otherwise.
It's 10:30 in the morning, this is KABU, and it's time for Film at 11. Hello, everybody.